I'm Lark Williams with a special Lotus Broadcasting presentation, an exclusive interview with legendary concert promoter Michael Scivo, whose book, Promoter, 5 Decades Behind the Musical Curtain, is now out and available. It's an absolute must read. You can find it at concertbook.net. This is certainly a compelling and a must read for anybody who's a rock and roll fan, A. B, if you were a local Las Vegas person, you've got to have it for the history. It's a virtual scrapbook of rock and roll with people in front and behind the scenes that, as you say, defined an era that changed not only the world, but it changed our lives. And Michael, kudos, congratulations. I love the book. Great read.
Thank you so much, Lark. It's really great to see you again.
Yeah, and, I know.
Just sitting here, just
we go
feels
way
like,
back.
Feels like yesterday.
We go back way back to KFM days.
Yeah, I've got the pictures to prove
it. And we
it.
Do have the pictures. How long did it take you, and what was the process? It's so detailed.
Yeah.
Your memory's amazing.
It is. It is, in a way, and until I miss the garbage pickup, you know, something like that, something simple in life. But overall, it took 6 years of writing, and I couldn't write every day. But, you know, you can't write every day. I don't ever feel I had writer's block.
It doesn't appear that way when you read the book.
It felt like, for me, it was I just had to let it pour out of me. And I remember the very first time that I made an attempt at writing, you know, it was about the Ted Nugent settlement story because I wanted something to really wake up my senses, and that was a pretty exciting night and following days.
We're going to talk about that story in a bit. That's one of them on my list to ask you about.
So, I mean, from that standpoint, things just poured out, and I wasn't really certain how or to arrange them or what chapters are. But that came later.
Oh, good.
Yeah. But, you know, you just lay it out, and then I actually had a little bit of help because I was a communications major when I did go to school, and I was a writer, and I wrote copy, and I was published in college, you know, writing stories about them and us, you know, the establishment and the hippies and the difference in our lives and such. So I was always one who
stirring it up constantly.
Well, I did.
It's another hat you wore, right, Michael? Just another one. Well, you were at the helm of a rock concert production company that did put stars on stage from intimate nightclubs to huge, vast arenas. And let me just drop some names here on some of the groups you've worked with. Rush, Peter Frampton, Scorpions, of course, Van Halen, great. So we got to get to a Van Halen story. Journey, Judas Priest, Ozzy, Black Sabbath, Cheap Trick, REO Speedwagon, Def Leppard, Ted Nugent, Jay Giles, UFO, Pat Benatar, Babies, Willie Nelson, and that's a partial list.
Yes, it is.
That's a partial list. So we're talking 5 decades, 17 cities. You're a busy guy. You were a busy guy.
I didn't know any better. And when I really look back to think that quite frankly, the way the world was constructed, we didn't have cell phones. Nope. They were barely out, and nobody wanted to carry one of those big, huge bricks around, you know, to talk on anything. And when you wanted to book an act, you actually sent a telegram.
There were no computers then.
There was no computers, you know, and they sent you a telegram back confirming the act, you know, and that process could take upwards of 10 days, you know, not like today where they just simply write done on an email and you know you have the booking. So,
well, I want to go back to a beginning because I think it paints a picture that really sets you apart in a lot of ways from other promoters. And again, you were cut from the cloth of the beginning of the nucleus of the original rock promoters. That because from the 60s to the 90s, rock and roll, it's a time that we'll never have again. It will never be the same. As you mentioned, the playing field's been leveled. Music doesn't have the same message that it did. Life is different, which is another reason the book is so compelling, because it encapsulates the time, the whole vibe that was rock and roll, that was the magic of the music. Not to say anything about what's going on now, but it's a time we will never have again. But what's interesting, I was raised here, but in the 60s, my parents moved here, and I was 9. You were here in the casino world at the age of 5 with showgirls and dancers as your babysitters. The town in the 50s was run the way the city was run, the way business was done with these guys. And for those of you who have the visual, I'm putting my nose sideways.
It's a bent nose.
it's the guys from back east, Detroit, Chicago, New York, etc. But it was not so much a great time to be a kid for me growing up until the music scene happened, and probably not for you, but it was the heyday of Vegas. And that had to have an influence on you when you're hanging out in casino showrooms as 5 years old.
Actually, it was wave two. The first wave came from the fact that I got up before my mother, who was a cocktail waitress and
friends with Bugsy Siegel.
And was, worked for Bugsy Siegel and was the only woman allowed by Virginia Hill, his hot-headed girlfriend, to serve Bugsy a drink because she trusted my mother. So my mother slept late, and I would get up in the morning, and I put that big wood box of a radio on. And there was only maybe five signals coming into Las Vegas, and it was a very eclectic programming. So you sat there, and you ran with it because you were listening to Sinatra, and then you were listening to Teresa Brewer, and then you might be listening to Ray Bolger, and then Arthur Godfrey was selling you something, in that big, powerful voice of his. And you know what? You soaked all that big band in. You soaked all of that music in. And then wave two, when my mother remarried and Frank Skivo came into our life and we built the Sahara Hotel from the ground up, and I became a hotel brat along with several other key people in Las Vegas, I was allowed to go to these showrooms, not only the Sahara Congo Room, but to go to showrooms and see all kinds of old school acts. So not only did we see the old school, we saw the new school coming up in Bobby Darin,
know,
and we saw Elvis Presley bomb the first time in Las Vegas, right. And so it was all of a sudden not a choice for me anymore. It was a vehicle.
Well, and again, like I have cousins that live in Fayette, South Dakota. Had I been raised there, I probably would have never been a showgirl or had the rock and roll career for 30 plus years. It seemed natural progression. We went to school even with people. In my class was Ava Minsky, whose father had Minsky Follies at the Silver Slipper. Her mother's a showgirl. So I'm learning as a kid, this is normal stuff, right? And then Buddy Rich. I went to school with Kathy Rich. And I'm at 12 years old going to see and meet Frank Sinatra and all of those guys in the Rat Pack. And I never forgot it, because to be backstage, I think it's the reason I took the career I did. Frank Sinatra had charisma. He was a rock star.
He was a rock star, absolutely.
And her father, Buddy Rich, and everyone changed when he came into the room. And I remember meeting him, and he took my hand and kissed my hand and said, "Aren't you just a lovely little girl?" And I saw the show, and I've been backstage ever since, my whole life.
Right.
But you're not going to get that childhood that you had anywhere in the world. But also the way you saw business being conducted had to make you give you an edge in some certain negotiations.
It wasn't always about the entertainment that I saw on stage. It wasn't that, Duke Ellington and Count Basie were my babysitters in the afternoon. It was about the click of the casino. And all of a sudden, you become a man-child. All of a sudden, you're looking around and you're seeing the effects of gambling on human nature. You're seeing how people interact. You're watching what people are made of, both the casino workers and our family at the Sahara, and as well as the tourists and why they came to Las Vegas and for what reason and what their limits were and so on and so forth. So, I saw both sides. You're so correct. And with that came an indelible lesson about being a calculated risk taker and not a ballsy promoter.
I do believe that sets you apart. Well, not just one of the things that sets you apart, but also you were able to be around guys like Jack Entratter, who was the entertainment director over at the wonderful Copacabana, and he basically orchestrated the Rat Pack. And again, it was a heyday of Vegas, and then you were in and out of here. But I know the effect it had. That moving here, the effect it had on me as a kid, and the direction that my life turned, as opposed to not being raised in Las Vegas. So you started basically as a promoter from the ground up. You kind of got sent back to California, right? Because you were getting into a little bit of trouble in your teens.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was always very rebellious. I mean, all of us brat packs, brats were in Las Vegas. I don't care if you came from a casino or not. Las Vegas had an effect on you. So, yes. You know, if you came from a edgy atmosphere or just where it was edgy, period, by the things that you saw and knew, you know, you could challenge a lot of things. And I challenged a lot of things early on in life. And that was the best thing that ever happened to me, being thrown out of Bishop Gorman High School.
For you locals, you know what we're talking about.
So with that, you know, I got sent back. Because I was familiar with Newport Beach and such, because we would vacation there. But I got sent back to California just in time to just embrace the California culture head on as it was exploding in the 60s.
Yeah.
And 62 is when I got there, and I became a board rider and a surfer, for those that don't know that terminology. And we went to the Rendezvous Ballroom every single Saturday and to see the Beach Boys for a buck, or Dick Dale, you know. Yeah. And there's some more stuff you saw, you know, and some more hot licks from coming off that stage and more things going on. And, you know, I can still listen to some of that surf music, and it's osmosis. I mean, I start flipping out. I start, like, you know, totally, I think I'm on a board somewhere, you know, in a pipeline, you know.
Well, that's the magic of music. You know, there's a lot of great quotes in the book, and it's a rich vein of great musical stories. As I've mentioned, we're going to get to a few here, too. But you said mine was the generation that came of age when rock music first turned its eyes toward becoming a major influence on society. So it was interesting for you to position yourself against some of the big boys. And we're talking like the Bill Grahams, you know, people that, not that the industry was dominated, but I love how, and this is so beautiful on your part, your time in L.A., if you could say how you set up, because you had to have connections. To be a promoter, you've got to be able to establish connections. And I love the story about... What was it, Columbia Records or Epic Records?
Oh, yeah.
The office that you set up.
That was a lot of fun, you know.
Well, tell everybody exactly. Well, yeah, fun. It's a classic story.
Your playing field in Los Angeles every night was the Los Angeles Troubadour.
Mm-hmm.
And when you hung there, you fattened your telephone book. You met everybody. We met everybody coming onto Doug Weston's stage for the first time. You know, the Eagles. I mean, Tom Waits. Just everybody's a baby act, you know. And you meet the record company executives as well. And I was given the privilege of out of friendship with a guy named Pat Siciliano.
Italian boy.
Yeah. who was head of publicity at Epic Columbia. And he says, now, I don't want you to overuse this, Michael, but you can use the coat closet in there. And it had a little desk in there and with a Coke machine. And it had a very important item, which some people may not even know what it is. It was called a Watts line. Okay, that's just a regular coaxial telephone cable. But if you picked it up and asked the operator to connect you, you could call anywhere in the world free. Well, all of a sudden, I didn't have a telephone bill anymore.
You're calling everybody.
Everybody. So, I mean, all of a sudden, everything that I dreamed about and not had to worry about paying a phone bill or added expense every month was there for the conversation. And I could hook up to every city and every manager and every act that I could possibly blah, blah into a phone and just, you know, bring it together. Eventually, after almost 3 years there,
in the coat room
with the coats, the department was audited, and the operators there gave in the reports, and it showed that Michael Schivo, who's Michael Schivo, had made more telephone calls than any vice president in the entire Columbia record system. So. I was escorted out one day and told, okay, your time's up. But I wasn't the only one to do this in L.A. There were guys prior to me, like Brian Stone and Charlie Green, who just walked onto a lot, you know, at like a studio at Paramount or something, commandeered an empty office, had the where for all to pick up a phone and say, hey, I need furniture down here. And, you know, they'd come with a truck the next morning, an office is set up, and so on and so forth. And now these guys are they're in business. They're in rock and rollers. They're in business. And what they're doing is commandeering and making telephone calls. And the next thing you know, they're managing Buffalo Springfield and Cher, you know, Sonny and Cher. So, you know, that's
creative
how things.
Creative license, right?
It was creative. You had to go for it with a lot of gusto back then.
Well, that's it. You've got to have the gift of two things, the gift of gab and the gift of big cojones. We can say balls. It's rock and roll, right?
Yes, you can say whatever.
You've got to have some major balls to do this. There's five decades is – I'm going to jump around because really the timeline just it all does kind of meld in. But it's interesting to me the progression and the development where you never gave up. You never seemed to get intimidated, and you had to be an intimidator. And you also, I think, had the gift of luck, being in the right place at the right time. Also, you're not easily intimidated, but you met early on the picture of you and John Lennon, and I love that story because the guy owed you money, right?
Right.
How did you commandeer that little meeting? It's Lennon.
I know. You know, it's just Billy Sunshine was his name, and he needed a loan against a black Les Paul, a guitar, and so I lent him like $50 or something against the guitar as collateral, and there was no story about anybody coming to get it. He was going to sell it one day, and so we bump into each other at the Troubadour in L.A. that night, and he says, "You're not going to believe this, but I have it sold." I said, "Oh, that's good. So I get my $50 back and with maybe a little extra 10%. I don't know, $5. That would buy something at Tommy's Burgers, you know, so whatever." He says, "No, John Lennon is going to come by and buy that." I said, "Okay, now we're talking." So, you know, and I go to his apartment and it's now midnight, no John Lennon. I'm saying, "Oh, forget about it." I'm just going in. I crash into bed and he comes and wakes me up about 2:30 in the morning. And he says, "Lennon's here. You got." So I get up, sleepy-eyed, and sure enough, there is John Lennon. You know, there is an actual.
What condition could he possibly have been in?
Well, what do you think? You know, the situation was, these were the days in which Yoko Ono cut him loose out of New York and sent him with a concubine.
May Payne?
Yes, May Payne. A Chinese girl. And that was his companion to keep him out of trouble. But, you know, that didn't stop John. But, you know, and he was always – by the time he hooked up with Harry Nilsson, I mean, anything could have happened, you know, and did, absolutely, including the time the two of them came to the Las Vegas Hilton here and threw a television set out of the top floor just to watch it, break in a zillion pieces. Those were days.
But no less, it didn't lessen the thrill of meeting. So at 2:30 in the morning.
No, not at all.
He's sitting in this guy's living room.
Yeah, he's fully out there. I mean, it is fully described in the book what was going on. But, you know, there is John Lennon, and he thinks that I own the guitar because I look like the businessman. Billy looks like the hippie, you know, and he's negotiating and counting out the money to me. And I take it and pull my loan out and hand it to Billy. And we take some pictures with a Polaroid of all of us. And then we start to – he starts to freak out a little bit. He needed a little something to keep going, actually. I don't want to get into what it was that Billy pulled out. Billy pulled out a big chunk of hashish. Now,
just a
calming agent. But John took it for granted that because he was John Lennon, you know, that big chunk was for him, and he swallowed it whole.
Oh, no.
Yes, right. And I had some vodka, and he chased it with that.
Is there any other way to take it out? I don't know.
So with that, we began to talk some more. He started to get a little more relaxed, and I knew.
I think so.
And it was osmosis for me because I was feeling everything. And anyway, we started talking about things that I could keep him there, because he really wanted to take the guitar and go. It was 3:30 in the morning, and it was, you know, he came for a particular reason.
A million o'clock.
So not Michael. He's not going to let John Lennon out the door, you know. Right. This is where I had to pull, you know, basic knowledge out of the hat. I knew I knew Ringo Starr's record producer, and he didn't like him. And I used to hang at Richard Perry's house, and here and there, and that kept him for a while. We talked deeper about his mother, Julia, in the song from the White Album, and basically got to know him even better because Julia was a mother that he never had. He was kind of shuffled off to a sister-in-law, and his mother was not really a mother to him. But at any rate, you know, here we
are. So you found a connection.
I found a great connection here and there that kept him there for about another 35 minutes. And so now we're sitting there in a circle on the floor where all late-night great conversations took place in the 60s, surrounded by furniture, of course. But we're sitting there, and John looks at the pictures. And
this is frightening. This is the scary part for me.
Yeah. Looks at everybody's picture and rips them up.
Yeah.
And then he holds my fate in his hand, and he looks at me, and he hands me the picture. And he says, "You can keep this." And, you know, that was a real privilege and honor for me to get that out of one of my heroes in life, you know, and to be able to communicate with him that way.
It speaks volumes just to see the picture of you two together in the book, because you can, I know what you went through having, when I read the story, and what that must have meant at that moment, where it would be so great just to have this picture of all the pictures that you've ever had, that one, you know, and that makes me say there's so many great stories that you have, but is there an artist or someone, even though you didn't promote John Lennon?
Oh, I did do a bag.
Oh, you did?
I did John indirectly.
Oh, that's right. You did the artist.
I did his erotic art show at UNLV, and that was.
We helped promote that.
Yes,
the radio
absolutely.
Station.
You
I
did.
Remember that.
Yeah, so I did do a little something with Yoko and that group with John's erotic and Yoko's erotic art, as well as their straight art. And so, to your questions.
Well, you know, you're a charmer, Michael, but you weren't able to charm everybody.
No, of course not.
And there were some hairy moments. I know I can pick three that I think are the what's your hairiest moment? Because there's some big ones.
Hmm.
You just couldn't pull the charm card out. It didn't work.
No, you know, and nor should it. You know, because you're not going to grow. You're not going to grow as a person unless you learn how to be a person all the way 360 degrees. You know.
But by the time you became a promoter, I mean, you say that you were sly and wily. You were known to be a big pain in the ass sometimes with negotiations and deals, and a very shrewd businessman.
I got my way. I got my way because all of the power sources in the rock business acted the same way. This is how you survived. And just because my markets were Reno, Nevada, and Las Vegas, Nevada, which were smaller than Los Angeles or smaller than New York City, didn't mean that I shouldn't be controlling my business the same fashion, from the same standpoint and fashion as the big boys, because that's how you held on to your turf.
Which is, wasn't there a point when Bill Graham tried to hire you?
Well, Bill tried
to. You had several run-ins with him, which are pretty ballsy, too.
I did, indeed. I fought Bill Graham for, I'm going to say, pretty close to a decade. And
kept him at bay.
I kept him out of Reno for a good, good long time. I'm not going to divulge this story of Bill Graham and I.
The one I'm thinking of?
Okay. Yeah, that New York.
Okay.
When we have a very intimate, powerful conversation with one another.
Mm-hmm.
But Bill was interested in my efforts because I was doing some of his acts. I was doing well in Reno.
He was ruthless. This guy was known to be absolutely, you know, terrifying to people.
Well, his nickname was the Wolf, and we'll leave it at that. Okay, you know, so.
But he didn't scare you.
He didn't scare me. I don't know. I had tenacity, and it maybe the same amount of tenacity that some of the other guys had. But Bill had a tremendous amount of tenacity. There's no doubt about it. Coming from Russia and being adopted and losing his family and running from the Nazis and so on and so forth, and his survival techniques were very, very high. But at any rate, he admired what I was doing, so he thought, well, maybe the best way to deal with Michael Scivo is to just make him a Bill Graham partner in Reno. And, you know, it didn't work for Bill. He couldn't charm me at that point. So, you know, we can't all charm each other. I was already flying pretty good and doing very well with big acts in Reno.
Yes, you
and
were.
So I refused the Wolf. And that did not make Bill happy.
That's no, it did not make him very happy.
So with that,
what's the line? Don't poke the bear. Don't poke the bear.
And, you know, a lot of times I did poke the bear.
Oh,
did
yes,
I not?
Did.
More than once. Yes, and I don't know why I did that. I did that
because you could. The time. I mean,
I don't know if it was always the right thing to do, though, Lark. I mean, seriously, now that I'm my age and I look back, I mean, I could have been a whole lot nicer to people. But at the same time,
now he says, "Is this rolling? Are we on tape?" Yes. Listen, I'm going to write that one down. And put it up. I'm going to put it onto my tape and carry it with me for people.
Yeah, I mean, you can skin a cat two ways. You can do it with sugar or you can do it with a knife, you know. So it, you know.
But I thought you were really creative in a lot of ways, like protecting your turf in Reno with some of the, because let's go back to the climate, to paint a picture for people that aren't, that didn't grow up in Las Vegas or Reno. I think Nevada, more than any other state, and we're going to talk about this story because there was a particular concert that caused just the boom to come down
right.
on rock and roll in this city, and it didn't bode well for Reno either. So you had a considerable challenge from government officials and city officials because they did not want kids corrupted by rock and roll, and it was really a fight for. I remember being a kid here. The Deep Purple concert, we got to talk about how that put the kibosh almost forever. We're still paying the price on that.
Well, that scenario, without naming names, was we felt a powerful promoter who had status in this town. We felt that there was a definite monopoly at the Las Vegas Convention Center, and that promoter just made it very difficult for us to get in. And yes, I had done Steppenwolf there in their prime. And yes, I had done Three Dog Night there and Jethro Tull. But all of a sudden, I couldn't even get a date anymore, nor mm-hmm. could this other guy, because this promoter mm-hmm. Had basically tied everything up. And, you know, it's still a juice town, but it was really a juice town back then. My goodness,
yes,
it was really tiny. And so
the old boys, at old that, school network.
Yeah, so at that point, the other promoter, not the one with the monopoly, but the other promoter and I started yelling monopoly across the United States. And boy, we got all the press in every showbiz magazine you could possibly think of, from Billboard to Cashbox to Variety magazine, about all of this. And, you know, the Convention Authority didn't like it too well. after all, we're the entertainment capital of the world, and we're supposed to have, you know, some dignity here. And all what was going on was really not that way. It was like finger pointing and you know, and so on and so forth. So in their infinite wisdom, the Convention Authority gets four of us together. And there was only really three of us in the deal. All of a sudden, there turned up to be a fourth guy in the deal who was under the wing of the primary promoter with the monopoly.
Ding, ding, ding. Correct answer.
So that changed the odds a little bit. And in their infinite wisdom, they decided that we would draw straws for dates, and we would go in sequential order. So the first one was the James Gang with the promoter that helped me break the monopoly, and he did pretty good with the James Gang. Joe Walsh was in the band at that time, and the second date in there was the Rory Gallagher opening up Fleetwood Mac, second bill, and Deep Purple closing the show.
Fleetwood Mac, second bill. That's how far back that
Yes,
was.
Correct.
And Deep Purple. There
and Deep Purple headlining. And
I was
the third.
A kid. I remember I wanted to go to that concert.
I had the third show in there coming up, which was Cat Stevens. And I was real excited. I was real.
Because you were next up to bat.
Yeah, I was
you
next
to get through the Deep
I'm next
Purple
up,
show.
Yeah. I'm next up to bat. And I'm sitting there in the back of the main floor. And, you know, because I'm in the biz, I know everything that's going on stage and what should be happening and what's not happening. And, you know, after Rory Gallagher just blew everybody away and Fleetwood Mac just really leveled the place with in terms of how they came across with things like Hypnotize and all those great old tunes back then. Then we noticed that, you know, that the stage is being struck. It's going bare.
Ruh-roh.
Yeah, it's not being built for Deep Purple. It's
being taken down.
And I'm saying something's very, very wrong here. I don't think that people were really totally onto it. And then they finally got onto it when the promoters who had the monopolies, boy, we'll call it, came out and addressed the audience in a very haphazard fashion. You know, when you have a microphone and you know the power of a microphone, Lark, you've been on air for a good many...
Over the years.
Oh, a lot of years, right? At any rate, he says from the microphone that the convention authority won't allow us to do the show tomorrow night. That's the first thing out of his mouth. He didn't even have that sequentialed properly by saying, Ian Gillan cannot perform tonight. There is no Deep Purple show.
He has Vegas throat.
He's got Vegas. He didn't say that. He says,
oh,
he says the first thing, he says, well, the convention authority will not let us make up the show tomorrow night. So everybody's wondering, huh?
A roof? What?
So now we're getting the message that there will be no Deep Purple show tonight. And someone picked up a chair, threw it at the guy, and on the stage, someone picked up another chair and threw it on stage. I grabbed my date and left, and because I could see what was about to happen. It was going to be mayhem.
Yep.
Absolute mayhem. And kids started throwing chairs all over and just running rampant through the corridors of the rotunda and taking chairs with them. They broke windows. They overturned a cop car or rocked it to death. I don't know if it actually went over. I can't remember. They ripped up the sprinkler system, and they really outnumbered the security, which was the Metro Police at that time, by probably 700% to one, you know, because there was not stringent requirements in those days. Well, what came out of that was the most stringent rock rules ever to hit any concert venue in the United States. You had to have 43 off-duty Metropolitan Police Department at any show, no matter if you had 3,000 there or 7,000 there. It didn't make any difference. Yeah, so that's a lot of money all of a sudden for Metro Police, who walked around arm in arm with donuts and coffee. And I swear, I know it's a bit of a cliche, but that ask them to do something, they wouldn't do anything for you, you know. But they were just on a gravy train, but they were there in case something happened. Not only did you have that scenario financially, you had another financial monster, which was before you could sell ticket one, you had to post in cash, because not many bondsmen were going to write promoters after what just happened in Las Vegas. Yeah. So you had to post $63,000 before you could sell any tickets whatsoever.
And this is when $63,000 was, it's still a lot of
tremendous
money.
It's a lot of money, no matter how you slice it and win.
They were trying to, you know, they wanted Vegas to stay an adult town. They were looking for any reason not to do concerts. And this just was a silver platter for
it
officials
really
to say, you have to meet these requirements, which were impossible.
We're
to
a
make.
Convention city, and you're lucky you can do some rock concerts. But what happened is the convention center was closed for business. And that's when I got I guess a lucky break, although I moved out of town again. I said, I had that brass ring right in my hand ready to go.
You were the next one.
I was the next one, and I was going to build on that and so on and so forth. And I wound up back in L.A., you know, starting all over again with, you know, primary acts in paying more for primary acts in secondary markets, you know, and in venues that—
Well, you knew that it was— It was going to take time to heal that, A.
Yeah.
But also, it ends up, because I think you're from Las Vegas and you were savvy and you knew, it ends up working in your favor because you were the only one,
left.
Be able to get the license, though,
right.
That you were able to use.
Right.
You know, that was a huge coup for you.
Well, there was Reno in between, and Reno was an absolute—
You had to come back to that.
I know, but I not only had a lot of fun doing country and country rock with Marshall Tucker and the Outlaws and Willie Nelson and Waylon Jennings and all those Texas guys that drive you crazy and ruin your health. It was—
Not like rockers.
No, no.
Those country guys are the bad guys.
The worst is the country guys out of Texas. They make rockers look like—
You too. took the wheel. You really took a different turn, though.
I totally did a 180, yeah.
And in fact, formed a different company, which I thought was a very creative name. It was very clever. And that picture of where you got your Trick Roper.
Yeah, I became Trick Roper. I fashioned myself after a guy named Abe Schiller, who was the host at the Dunes, who wore these beautiful, elaborate country western clothes. Basically, I became a drugstore cowboy. I mean, I didn't try to pass myself off as, you know, a guy that was rodeoing. You know, that's for sure. I was a drugstore cowboy that loved rock and roll and was into this Texas stuff. And we had a great...
Because you were a businessman. You saw an opportunity.
I saw an opportunity. But it was something about that radio that I go back to that was feeding me country music.
That's what I think.
And that all of a sudden struck a nerve and a chord in my life. And... So I stayed in that business and moved around. Steve Wynn gave me his lounge at the Golden Nugget, and I moved my acts from L.A. to Lake Tahoe at Cal Neva Lodge.
It was just bit of a run-in with Steve Wynn, I would say.
Yeah, and I had. Yeah, I did. I did. Steve.
But who hasn't?
Who hasn't? Yeah, this is very well put. You know, Steve is a brilliant guy. I mean, you can't deny what he does. I mean, he's quintessential Mr. Las Vegas, even though
in your face kind of a guy.
And he'll tell you what he thinks. And basically, I did him a great service. And once I wasn't as useful to him, then, you know, I was out. But people have a dozen stories in this town of the same nature about the guy. But that didn't take away from what he's done for the town. I mean, I really don't. No. I look back, I don't care. It doesn't make any difference.
But you've never backed down to anyone, whether it's the Bill Graham or the Steve Wynn. But you've got, you saw what happened there. You handed him something. You got, you know, a little bit of a cold shoulder on that episode, but you kept moving on.
I just kept moving on. You know, nothing so permanent that it deserves a tattoo in your life, and you just got to keep moving.
And you were promoting, wasn't it, the cable guy, Gary Hill, who kind of got you onto the country thing and then the Texas guy? And you saw, I like how you saw that opportunity, but again, like you said, it goes back to the radio.
As a kid,
played everything. So you had that exposure to country music and an affinity with it.
I did. And as well as jazz, which came later in my life.
So you promoted everything.
I really did. I was a little awkward at rap, but
but you got to try.
I did try, and it worked out okay. You know, at any rate, I found myself in Reno, and we can't get into all the things that happened in Reno because Reno truly was like the Wild West.
Oh my. The stories are just endless, and they're wonderful. You were at your sharpest with some of the stunts you pulled there. On the Van Halen announcement on stage was a classic.
Yeah. I'm not gonna go on that one because it is such a bizarre thing that I did.
Oh, it's bizarre. Let that be just one of the teases to read the book. What do you consider to be maybe your best pitch that even surprised you that you pulled it off?
Well, now, that's a very difficult one because I never stopped to think what I was doing. A lot of it was so instinctual, and it is even to this day that some things that I just look at and I know that I should be doing, and it may have nothing to do with music. It's just how I feel about life. You see it; it's in front of you. You know you're supposed to be a part of it, and you wind up being a part of it somehow, some way, and. You know, it's not that I didn't think about, you know, who was going to come up next and who was to the right investment bear baby act to break into a nightclub so that, you know, we could take her or him into the next level. It was just something that just happened because it was happening very fast. We're into the 70s now, so we're no longer into the 60s. The 60s was we were being spoon-fed you know, peace and love and so on and so forth. And the music came with that, as did the message. But by the 70s, that amp got just a little louder, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
And so things happened. So things started happening. They started happening fast. And the word hard rock surfaced, you know, hard rock. Way before metal, it was hard rock. Yeah. And so you just learned to just go with the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And I'll tell you what. I'm not blowing smoke. Part of my major thrust in life was having terrific people inside of Lotus Broadcasting, not just in Las Vegas, but in Reno.
Do I smell smoke? I hope not.
No, you don't smell. No.
I know. We were with you all the way, Michael.
It's not only Las Vegas, but Reno as well, with my people up there that were behind me that made things happen.
Dan Cook and those guys.
Yeah, Dan Cook and all those guys, Max Volume, all of those incredible people. And by the time I did get back to Las Vegas and was running both Las Vegas and Reno, you know, what was going on here was incredible in terms of all the people that I had happening for me.
You surrounded yourself well.
I did, and I had a lot of help. I mean, because a promoter only can do so much with be effective. I'm not on the air. I'm not pushing the show. It was.
But you knew how to motivate. You got more bang for your buck. You ask Tony Bonici or anybody who had to deal with you. The stories are endless of how you cut deals. Oh, really? We were going to barter that many tickets? I thought it was. And speaking of that, I don't think you ever had to pay for anything ever. You learn, and that's a Vegas thing too, where you were able to trade out airlines and restaurants and hotel rooms, and that's very much a Vegas thing where we comp each other, you barter things out. Oh, really? I have to pay for airtime? I didn't know people pay for airtime. What a concept!
Actually, this is who I am. I was raised Italian. I think like a Jew. I trade like a Dutchman, and I bought talent like a Scot.
And okay, we'll be leaving out.
No, we really not.
not much.
And that's pretty much what happened. And I love trading. I don't know where I got it from, but I love trading. And I traded a lot of things, and I wound up cross-trading. I had so much trade. Oh, I don't even want to talk about it. You know, it became
everything was traded out.
Traded out. And it was great. And I wasn't the only guy doing it, but I did it a lot, and I did it more frequently than
anybody else.
Yeah, I had so much trade, I traded it back to the radio stations for time. You know?
And there was one promoter, we don't have to mention him, who challenged you on that, what kind of deals you could pull in Vegas. And you said, oh, really? Because he didn't believe you, this one promoter. And so he said, like, with one day notice, he wanted like 18 tickets to Siegfried and Roy, the hottest show in town. And you made one phone call, Bernie Human.
Right.
And you were able to. And I mean, that's a great. Of course, Bernie Human probably.
He had a conniption.
Front row tickets to concerts.
No, believe me, it wasn't even 2 days of Bernie's back on my line saying, "I need 20 tickets to your next concert." You know, because that was how Vegas was. There wasn't a lot of breathing room. People did things for each other, but it was also like, "Hey, it's not the end of the world. You'll get yours." You know, but people just collected quick back, you know. It was like, I don't know why, but that's the kind of
town. The town was.
The town was, you know. A lot of things were going on.
Yeah. Certainly not that way anymore, but.
No,
indeed. Not to the degree that you rode that one.
We all had our ways to do things in this town, and I had some very unusual and clever ways of doing things.
You did, and I think, again, it goes back to you being a kid with the way that the city was run and business was done. Other promoters did not have that background, and other promoters wouldn't occur to them to make this a deal or to attempt. You had to try, you know, let's try and do it. And I thought there's so many stories in there that are creative because there was no rules on how it had to be done. You know, let's just see if I can up the ante or do this. And
we were paving the rock and roll road. I mean, all of us
were scrappy. You were down
all of us were doing it. But I mean, the promoters really were doing it, you know, and I was doing it in this state with everyone's help. And paving that road was incredible. We knew we were paving it. We knew what we were doing. And we took pride in that because we go back to that same situation in this world where I think I still am today. You know, I'm still, dare I say, on the air. I'm a leftist. I am a liberal. And so we just did it that way.
Where's the quote that you said here? One of them is, in the old days, I could be too tough of a businessman for my own good. The countless skimming of deals in my favor added to my prowess and reputation. But while it produced respect in some circles, it created resentment in others. As my decades of independent success mounted, whatever, we promoters all learned you have to have a thick skin. I love, you know, that quote because it was whatever, you know, sorry that I got the deal over you. That's the way it goes. But the other one that ties in with that, and I want you to discuss some of these, we'll call them creative licensing deals, Stealing is an American institution. It's not actually called stealing, of course. It's a gesture based on the belief that you deserve more than the other side wants you to have. It's not always about greed, but it certainly is fueled by it. The government has been doing it for decades, as has corporate America. Arranging the numbers concerning who gets paid what after a rock concert certainly doesn't hurt the masses. It simply levels the playing field for the promoter. Rule number one, just don't get caught. Michael, that's, you're just blatantly saying there was some real intent. That brings me to Ted Nugent and his brother.
Yeah, well, before we get into that story, though, I mean, it really was, there was no padding of bills in the 60s. X got paid top dollar of $7,500. Tickets were $3 and $3.50. I remember when I went to 450, they called me a capitalist pig in this town. And it never stopped. It went 550 and up and up and up every single year. However, we did not pad our bills because the artists were on a flat. We didn't need to. The act made well. We made well. We were in a cool scene in the 60s, and all of that was fine. However, when the acts and the agents and the managers put their structure together to create more income for themselves, I mean, it wasn't just that they were making money from mechanical rights of their records being played on the air. People probably don't know that they get paid, you know, 2 cents or 3 cents every time. That adds up to millions across the United States on a yearly basis. It's not that they got their sales on their LPs in those days, or the touring money, or the merchandise. It's just that they just kept wanting more of everything, more and more and more. So all of a sudden, our $5 tickets were $17, and our $17 tickets became $30 tickets. And $30 tickets just absolutely – I was pretty much out of rock and roll by that time. But I think everyone would like to see a $30 ticket again.
Yeah.
You know, it's pretty hard to come by considering where $400, $500 tickets to see the Stones or, you know, other acts
insane.
That you want. Yeah, it's insane. And as long as people will pay that, then it's going to continue to escalate. But going back to the fact that as it escalated and we were forced to
be creative with financing.
With financing,
right.
Because, you know, all of a sudden the settlement was the dance. It wasn't the concert anymore that was the dance. It was the settlement.
The new age for promoters. It just, the ante just got higher there.
Yes, set
that. And with hard rock, right?
Yes.
Because it was even, and this surprised me too, your knowledge of equipment and what the writers became and the demands of that never were before. It was straight up, kind of straight
so
ahead.
Easy in the old days. You know, I don't know if many people realize that the very first rock promoters in the 50s and early 60s were wrestling promoters who gave these acts nothing because they had the relationship with the building in the municipal auditorium.
And the venues.
And they wouldn't even feed them. You know, they did nothing for these acts, the English acts or the early American acts that they played. But, you know, they've come a long way, baby, on their rider in terms of things that they get from.
What was the most demanding rider of any group? It was just ridiculous over the top.
Well, there's lots of stories about Van Halen's rider with the brown M&Ms, you know, that you couldn't have.
Were those true stories?
Yes. I mean, we'd go have to buy M&Ms and then hire someone to fish out the brown M&Ms, you know. And it wasn't like they wanted just six packs for the six guys on stage. They wanted a bowl of M&Ms. So you hire your runner. Okay, now don't get sweaty in there with your hands. But you got to pick out these brown ones, and that's the way it is because they don't like brown M&Ms. To them, they didn't give a hoot what it was, you know. They just wanted to do that. I can tell you they sent us, I think it was Def Leppard sent us on a wild goose chase once with Whitefish. Now, it wasn't Whitefish.
It was an English Whitefish.
It was something, a fish that didn't exist and was actually a pseudo name for something off color.
Oh, that's right. I remember that.
So, you know, our caterers all over town said, I cannot find this fish, Michael. I got to have this fish. This band is too important to me, you know.
It's Def Leppard,
and I'm in the Aladdin now, and I'm running things, and we got to make it right, you know. So That happens.
That's the power of editing.
So, you know, the writers became pretty crazy, especially when you had a couple $100 of beautiful shrimp that they never ate. Okay? All they were interested in was the Dom Perignon or the Jack Daniels. You know, that was pretty much what was going on. They ate a little bit or hardly anything. You know.
So all of this increases the bills. You've got a catering bill you didn't have before.
Right.
You've got, sound, but even, you know, with the sound equipments when the bigger bands came on, there was that horrible fiasco with, was it Rush in Reno, where there were how many stages, and because there was so much equipment and the truck backs up.
Right.
Into the,
that story is probably the one of the worst nights I've ever had. Although I've had some pretty bad nights, including Sam Kinison. But overall, that was a whole political ploy in Reno by the government to get me busted out and to send me out of town. There was only one stage in those days in Reno, and it was held at the Reno Centennial Coliseum, and I was that was a monopoly held by the same guy. And until I busted that, I had to play the 2,500 seat Nevada Fairgrounds, which everybody played, including Elton John. Elton John's first date in Reno, he was up there on stage saying in this barn where they do horse shows, saying, "Yep, it's just you, me, and Trigger," and that's how it was. And so getting
we
the
didn't
stage
have venues, there weren't a lot of venues.
Well, I created a lot of venues as we needed them, but we had to get the stage over from the Coliseum to the fairgrounds. I had to be trucked over, and I had done two successful shows. I had done Journey in Reno, and I had done Climax Blues Band, and it's in this. I can just hear these good old boys saying, "How do we stop this guy? How do we stop him? Well, if he doesn't have a stage, you know, maybe he'll go away." So somebody cancels the stage on me to truck over to Reno Fairgrounds. And I'm sitting there at 7:30 in the morning with Rush trucks, and there's no stage there. Well, of course there's no stage there, because there never was going to be a stage for Michael. Michael was not getting a stage for that show, and Michael is going to leave town, and we're going to force him out. And
so you've got all the Rush trucks, all of their stuff.
Yeah.
And no
well,
stage.
We threw up a stage, okay. But then, you know, all of a sudden Rush made a mistake and backed into it. I won't tell you the rest of it.
No, it was crazy,
but it was also created an incredible desire to see this band when I brought them back a year later. You know, we were in the big hall. I had broken the monopoly now, and Rush sold out every last seat. In fact, I remember going in to pay the rent check to the Coliseum board members, all the good old boys, that night. And there was mysteriously out of nowhere a Jethro Tull show put up against me by another promoter the night before.
Imagine that.
Yeah, imagine that. And so as I hand the guys, you know, $6,000 for the rent, they said, "Can I see your remaining tickets?" And I said, "You mean the Deadwood, don't you?" And they says, "We don't know what Deadwood is." Well, Deadwood is an English term for what's left over for the tickets. Everyone in the biz should know that. But I said, "Well, I don't have any tickets left. We sold all 7,000 seats." And there was like dead silence. And they said, "Even with that other show against you last night?" Well, that's when they had to realize that hard rock and heavy metal had come of age. And it was no longer, you know, maybe some of the great stars like Jethro Tull that drew big audiences.
Well, it's a good thing for you that you don't care whether you're liked or not, because that's some intimidating stuff right there. I mean, that's blatant where you can't interpret it any other way than "you want me out of town."
Well, is there any other way to look at it?
A horse in your bed and a gun to your head is the next thing, right?
That's pretty much it.
But there was, you know, you survived, and concert promoters do always have a risk. I think there was more of a risk in the time of this transition. But you had one particular group where it was almost like a dark cloud every time you tried to book, where it just, it, you know, and I'll mention that it's Ozzy and it's Black Sabbath. And
sure.
You could not have had more bad luck than that one thing over and over and over.
And I don't know if it was because I went to Bishop Gorman High School and I was raised Catholic or what. You can edit that out.
No, that's the stuff you want to keep.
At any rate, you know.
I mean, my gosh, the first time you booked them. What, Randy Rhoads dies right before the show, right?
Yeah.
There
were so many things that would happen with that. But, you know, the power.
There are funny stories when I read them, but I really felt for you, especially the one that then happens again here in Vegas when you come back. 8:30 in the morning, you go, where's it the writer? I'm drinking booze. You just start drinking. You said, what else am I going to do?
Well, yeah. Well,
you're sitting there at 8:30 in the morning waiting for the trucks to arrive
right.
at the rotunda and nothing. And there weren't cell phones, so you'd have – and it was a weekend, so you have no way to find out. Let me get this straight. Black Sabbath was in Salt Lake City. They're en route here. You have no idea what happened.
Don't have a clue.
So all I get. Drinking.
No, I didn't drink quite yet. But what I did was made a call to my answering service in Reno, and yes, there was that fatal message there that Bill Ward, the drummer, had slugged it out with the other members of the band, and that there was no Black Sabbath any longer.
The day before your show.
The day before my show, with every single seat sold out. You know, it was incredible. And that's when I said, oh, Lord, this, what am I going to do now? I suppose that rum looks pretty good. Anyway, you know, being raised in a town like Vegas 24/7, it could be a cool thing because you could learn a lot, you could do a lot, but it could be difficult to survive and be healthy too, and I always had
Absolutely.
To watch out to be on top of my understanding of this town, because as you got older there was more temptations, but just generally, yeah, there was some bad luck there, and once I got all cleared up, and
wait a second, let me go page two, Paul Harvey, which is an old school phrase. So a year later, you're trying to get the makeup. Now it's just such a classic story because it's one, two, like here's for strike three. A year later, you get the makeup concert. Finally, you get right the money in your hands for, and you had to push. For a year to even get that to happen, yeah.
Sharon
right?
Sharon Arden just ignored the phone calls, and I'm out $26,000. And
right.
Yes, you know, what am I going to do? I mean, Sharon, I'm going to have to sue you and everybody in the band, and she's not going to like that. And okay,
and it
Michael,
went on and on and on,
yeah,
back and forth,
yeah.
Suing. I'm suing you. You're suing. It's, and then you finally get the money, and then it's the ride, the airport ride.
I get I play the date. I play the date, and you know, I don't know that will tell the story.
Okay. You got to read what strike three was, because it was
a blow. I'm talking about you really had to ask yourself, what in the hell are you doing with this dark cloud of a band around you, even though they are a centerpiece of yeah. rock activity?
Yeah.
You know, what are you doing? It doesn't match up with you, right? You know, you had good luck bands, and I had a bad luck band, and that
was it. Though you didn't ever have, you had some. I mean, really, like I said, hairy moments. But hairy and the dark cloud of those stories that followed that, you would have to step back and say, "What have I done here?
Yeah.
This, you can't write this, but you did write it." So
it's all in the book, folks.
It is all in the book. When I asked you about hairiest moments, the Barricade story with Van Halen, you were almost killed on that.
Yeah, I almost lost my life, squashed to death by my own crowd. It's that there's a lot of stories in this book, and I think at some point we need to say how you get this book, because this book is not – you can't go to a bookstore and buy this book. This book is available only on the internet. Yes, it's a self-published book, and it's I like it. It's got class. It's got great art. It's got great pictures, and it's got great stories.
Well, it's a compelling read, and as I mentioned, for anybody who's a rock aficionado, a music fan, it's across the ages. If you're certainly from the 60s to the 90s at a time, as we mentioned, we'll never have this time again. This just reads, you can't put it down. It took – I cannot believe how detailed and how wonderful your memory is, because it jarred me, having been raised here in radio my whole life since I'm 19 years old. You know, it's just an incredible read. It is available at concertbook.net. It's called Promoter, 5 decades behind the musical curtain, and there's – I still got a million more questions unless you're tired.
Oh, no, we can talk about it. I just like interject that, okay. that for any of you that are interested or we've piqued your interest here to have a piece of history and to mm-hmm. know the insides of what really happens behind the musical curtain, that rock concert promoting is and certainly was a treacherous business. It was not all glamour. It really wasn't, although that's the way it looked. You know, we look like we were glamorous, and we were, I suppose, to many people. However, it was not a glamorous business. It was something that
cutthroat and backstabbing.
Yes, absolutely.
This is not where you're forging friendships.
No.
Did you even have friends with other promoters? How could you? Where's the trust factor here?
I had a group of promoters that out of Los Angeles, out of San Diego, that I was friendly with, and I kept friends with for even to this day. And another one in San Francisco. But, you know, basically you had a lot of acquaintances, okay, because it's nothing more. What we were in, this business and this paving of the rock and roll road was nothing more than a gigantic boys club, I swear. That's what it was. We were just all in a great big boys club. And in this boys club, you were on the inside and, you know, you did this and you laughed a lot and you fought a lot and you forgot about it and laughed the next day, but it was craziness and it was highs and lows that most people will never understand. And it has nothing to do yeah. with anything substance wise. It had to do with our ability to survive.
You thought you knew rock and roll. This is the ultimate tell-all book, Promoter, 5 decades behind the musical curtain, from one of America's most durable concert presenters, Michael Scivo. True and transparent stories with nothing held back about paving the rock and roll road he and everyone went down. The lowdown on promoter wars, the agents, managers, and the mergers that have nearly ruined the concert business. Promoter, an entertaining and revealing book on the concert scene, available now at concertbook.net.